573, Morgan v. Continental AG. Robert Slattery representing the plaintiff petitioner, Christine Morgan.
That is correct, Your Honor. With me are Al Gessler and Nicole Patbank. With permission of the court, opposing counsel, and Tom and Chris Morgan. I'm here today, obviously, to defend a unanimous jury verdict of causal negligence, which was rendered in September of 1997. The case was also mistried on an issue of strict liability, with a 10-2 vote in favor of strict liability and a third different dissenting vote on damages. The two questions before this court is, did we prove and offer evidence that Continental Tire knew or should have known of the specific defects that caused this tragic accident? And if they knew that, what was their conduct in response to that knowledge? What it is that Continental knew or should have known is the specific hazard of belt separation that is inherent in steel-belted fly tires. You know, the law in this state is very rich and includes at least six prior cases where juries find negligence and reject strict liability. The reasons for that we could speculate on, but this is not a new case. And we have a rich body of case law that addresses the topic, and we've tried to restrict our citations in our brief to cases that come before the court only on issues of negligence. The standard of what Continental knew or should have known is an objective standard, not a subjective standard. That's important. That's important in our judgment because that is proved not only by what comes from the mouth of Continental witnesses. They are charged with knowledge and bound to keep abreast of technical literature, such as the patents which were introduced in this case, talked about extensively, and constitute a pivotal part of the case in terms of what Continental should have known. There are cases that have come before this court that talk about knowledge post-manufacture. We're not talking about that here. We're talking about patents that were in existence 5 and 6 years before the manufacture of these tires. What do those patents say? Those patents say directly, number one, that the danger of belt separation when you try to adhere steel to rubber is a known danger in the manufacture of these tires. And the reason for that is explained in the patents and the testimony. It's physics. It's tough to get rubber to stick to steel, and you have to chemically treat it, and it's subject to even minor errors in the manufacturing process. If the rubber is slightly too hot or too cured or contaminated in any way, it simply does not stick. The solution proposed in the patents is what is referred to as a double wrap cap line. One that goes around the tire twice so that it is not dependent on a single splice. The way that it works is that the nylon shrinks with heat and it squeezes the belts that want to pull apart together. It resists the centrifugal force of the tires in their normal use going down the highway, wanting to pull the steel belts and the rubber apart. When they are pulled apart, they lose their strength. The tires weaken. It's inside the tire. It cannot be discerned either by observation of the tire. It cannot be discerned by driving the vehicle. And this is a defect that takes thousands of miles to develop. The specific defect in this case is no way contested. Our expert in this case, Mr. John Taylor, and the only Continental employee ever to examine those tires, Victor Blumel, both relied on the physical evidence of the tires to define the defect. Does that end the proof in a negligence case? No, it doesn't. But they both agree it's massive belt separations that took thousands of miles to develop, and it's the failure of the corrective device that's on there for only one purpose. The only reason a cap fly is put on tires, and it doesn't have to be. Some manufacturers gain adhesion by a carefully mechanized adhesive process that's closely monitored in the manufacturing process.
Mr. Slattery?
Yes.
In the Court of Appeals decision, which deals with whether or not there's any evidence to sustain this jury verdict on known or should have known. What the Court of Appeals said, and I'm looking at page 5, appendix 5, the Mordens argue that Continental was aware that the snow tires had adhesion problems and that Continental's use of a single cap fly with a splice rather than a double-wrapped cap fly was negligent. The Mordens, however, did not present any evidence in support of this argument, namely that Continental was negligent in either the manufacture or the design of the snow tires. The Mordens expert testified that the causes of the loss of adhesion are either in manufacturing or in the operation. The expert offered several examples of manufacturing problems that would cause a loss of adhesion, but he didn't opine that any of those problems had occurred during the manufacture. The Mordens therefore failed to establish that Continental did anything during the manufacturing process that breached the duty of ordinary care and caused the adhesion between the steel belts to degenerate. So that's the first thing they say. You didn't have any evidence to show negligence either in manufacture or design. The second thing that the Court of Appeals opinion says is that the Mordens did not present any evidence that Continental knew or should have known that the single cap fly design was unsafe. They never had any other complaint, and that there was no standard or regulation that the snow tires failed to meet. So my question to you, the only thing I think you have to show, maybe I'm wrong here, is that there is evidence, any evidence, to show, one, negligence in manufacture or design, and two, that Continental knew or should have known. So I wonder if you could marshal the evidence.
I will marshal the evidence, and I'll begin with the patents.
Okay, you said that the patents indicate that this was not designed well because it would raise these issues, and you say they should have known that.
The patents directly state three things. Number one, that the hazard of belt separation is known. Number two, that the solution is to double wrap a cap ply. Number three, that a single wrapped cap ply, and I'm quoting from the patent, is known in the art, but it is not a structure that overcomes tire distortion and ply separation at high speed. The single wrap does not work. This is confirmed by what Mr. Taylor said. He said the forces in a tire are such that in something so important in holding the tire together, you must use a double wrap. The patents say a single wrap pulls apart in the manufacturing process.
So your argument is that this is, in effect, common knowledge among manufacturers, or should be common knowledge. They're therefore held to that knowledge.
6 years before the manufacture of these tires. That is absolutely correct, Your Honor.
All right. That gives, since you have two things, at least under the Court of Appeals, to show, one is ordinary care in the manufacturer design. So you're saying, are you saying the patents show lack of ordinary care in the design?
They show knowledge of the hazard, and they show lack of ordinary care in the design. What Continental did here is select a design technique of a single wrap using a splice, and they're not using the splice that's talked about in the patent. The patent talks about a splice that extends the ends of the belt over one another, and it depicts it in the patent. That's not what Continental used. They took the discredited single splice and reduced it. The testimony of Mr. Blumel is that the design of that splice is as close to zero as possible. That's like a butt splice.
Did any expert testify on... what I'm looking for are specific acts of negligence, and this is a follow-up of the Chief's question. What are the specific acts of negligence that you feel the evidence will sustain a finding of in this case?
The evidence that I just recited proves conduct on the part of Continental in selecting a discredited design for a safety device on a tire. That nylon cap ply is a safety device.
So the specific act of negligence, and I feel comfortable, I guess, in trying to put what you're saying into my words, the specific act of negligence is
using a discredited design that the patent says does not hold the belts together. And so, then reducing that further to a butt splice that the witness, the testing witness for Continental, says, I'm unaware of any tests we made of that butt splice in terms of its strength. That is specific conduct in the design of that tire.
Mr. Slattery, can you tell us what a butt splice is?
Yeah, I can illustrate it for you. A butt splice, can you find the illustration?
If you're going to step away from the rostrum, I think you have to have a mic that goes with you. Does he have one?
You're going to give us an exhibit. We have, Mr. Slattery, the same exhibit that you have in your appendix, which we all have, 338 to 340, which are your colored. Please, Mr. Slattery, we're going to need, if you're not going to be at the microphone, we'll need you to have a handheld one.
I hadn't intended to use this, Your Honor, but in light of
the question,
we did have an illustration made, and
okay.
It'll save all kinds of time.
Do you object?
I do not.
Okay.
Mr. Slattery, the marshal has a microphone.
The second page of that set of exhibits illustrates a double overlap, that which is recommended by the patent. It illustrates a single overlap, that which is talked about in the patent and discredited. And it illustrates the Continental butt joint, which is as close to zero as possible.
Just a minute. He's not using that document. He's using what is labeled here, Record 408, Exhibit 748. Do you have extra copies for opposing counsel?
Right here.
Thank you. Can I assume this is from the record?
This is it?
Is this taken from the record?
No, I'm only referring to the second page.
Okay. Thank you.
But this is in the record, please.
These are taken from the patents. These are illustrations taken from the patents, and I can show you that in the record. I can give you the record reference.
Okay. That's all I want to get. Thank you.
That illustrates a butt splice.
Where in the patents, what language are you specifically referring to in the patents? I presume it's somewhere on page appellate's, the appendix 329.
Yes.
Could you give me the language that you're referring to?
The language is quoted in our brief. I can tell you the quoted language states that the hazard is known, and the quoted language that I just referred to relates to the overlap splice, and that language, and I'm quoting from the patent, is known in the art, but is quotation marks not a structure that overcomes tire distortion and ply separations at high speeds. It doesn't work, is what the patent says. That's what the witness Taylor says. It doesn't work. He further says he knows of no tire company that, while some do use the overlap type splice, he knows of none that use the butt splice and reduce the overlap as close to zero as possible.
So the language from the patent that you are quoting, and I take it you're referring to the language that's on page 7 of your brief and appears in the first column of the appendix 329, last paragraph.
Yes, it says, it is known that many types of tires, especially radial ply carcass tires, often fail at high speeds because separations occur in the shoulder zones of the tires where the edges of the belt plies are located. Such ply separations are due to the cord ends at the edges of the belt plies becoming detached from the surrounding rubber under the combined effects of centrifugal force acting on the tire, flexing of the tire, and heat buildup in the tire. That's why you put the cap ply on, to minimize the distortion in flexing and to squeeze the belts together. But that has to be strong enough and constructed in a manner to deal with those forces, and it doesn't work if you do it with a single type.
Well, why should Continental know about this patent?
For the same reason that the manufacturer of the lawnmower in the Yeezy case should have known that it's dangerous to back up a lawnmower with a blade on it. They pointed in that case to the literature where they reported that there were failures if you do that. Now, in the Yeezy case, I've never seen a lawnmower that you can't back up with a blade on it. But that was found to be a predicate of a finding of negligence based on the fact that there was published information that people do that and that accidents occur. This is published information in the tire industry, and Continental should know that because the standard of care is an objective one that charges them as a manufacturer of a potentially dangerous tire with the knowledge of the industry as to what works and what doesn't work to solve known belt separation problems. They're charged with that knowledge by the law, and the jury in this case was so instructed.
Mr. Slattery, when your expert, Mr. Taylor, testified, did he testify that both of these tires failed at the same time?
That they failed at the same time and in the identical manner.
And what was that?
Because of belt separations that were massive and extended around the circumference and across the treads of both tires, that they were like two bombs ready to go off because those separations robbed the tires of their strength. And when that car went over a bump in the road that literally hundreds of thousands of other cars went over, these two tires failed, and they both failed at precisely the same spot at the Caply splice, and Continental's Victor Blumel examined the tires and came to the identical conclusion.
Now let me ask you, sir, because I understand what the record has in it, but there also was testimony, and if I'm mistaken, I want you to correct me, that automobile upon which this was, the bandwagon, I guess called, these were not the correct tires to put on the bandwagon, and also, and I guess this was in the Court of Appeals opinion, also that there was a possible overload. It was pulling two sailboats, pulling one and carrying the other, if I understand that.
With the court's indulgence, there was no evidence that this vehicle was overloaded. Attached to the appendix is the last exhibit, is the exact weight on these tires in relation to their carrying capacity.
That's appendix 341.
Yes. These were like 600 pounds underloaded, not overloaded. In terms of it being the wrong tire for the vehicle, it's related only to inflation pressure. And the only thing that could occur from that is not an abuse of the tires. They didn't fail because they were on a Volkswagen Vanagon. They failed because of adhesion problems. And there are pages and pages of testimony and also tests, Exhibit 150 in the case, that the overinflation that mismatch could have caused. First of all, there's no direct evidence that these tires were ever overinflated. Secondly, there's no physical evidence found by any witness that the tires show the wear pattern that would be the result of overinflation. They would wear in the middle. They don't have that wear pattern.
Mr. Slattery, are these old tires?
These were old tires in terms of the fact that they were stored and on the shelf for 10 years before they were sold as brand new tires by Lee Wendowski, the individual who sold them to Tom Morgan, as new tires. There is no shelf life that Continental puts on these tires. There isn't one shred of testimony that these tires were stored poorly, that they had any evidence of deterioration. The evidence is in the tires themselves. I have a picture of them here that I can show you. That's part of the appendix. These look like perfectly good tires today. They were used for only half of their useful life. They have good tread on. They show no marks of abuse or misuse.
Was there testimony that they had been used for only half of their useful life?
Absolutely. With the court's permission, I have an enlargement of an exhibit which is used in the case that shows the tires. Could you put that up, Mr. Patton? This is a police photograph of the tires at the scene of the accident. You can see they have good tread. The testimony is that if you cover up the two identical ruptures that are found in the tires, they look like perfectly fine tires. There are no cuts. in the tires, such as in the Woolgett case. There are no signs of impact. There are no signs of abuse of the tires. We've delineated the exculpatory proof of other causes as part of our testimony and recited the references in our brief.
Mr. Slattery, I want to get back to this patent because you seem to rely so heavily upon it. I do not know patent law, but as I look at this, at your appendix, why should I accept this as gospel? I mean, this is what somebody has said, but I would assume people have patented perpetual motion machines.
This is also what's testified to by the witness.
So it's only good when it combines with Taylor's testimony. Is that what you're saying?
No. It's notice as to what the industry has knowledge of. The idea of belt separation is not a secret in the tire industry. The solution of using a cap ply is not and was not a secret to Continental. The evidence that they put a cap ply on this tire shows their knowledge of the underlying adhesion problem.
But don't you have to show more than what the words that appear on a piece of paper? Don't you have to show general acceptability in the industry and widespread use? I mean, otherwise, we've simply got one person's word here, or whoever the... And it could well be self-serving what this patent is all about.
Our proof did not rest with the patent. Our proof was followed by the testimony of the expert witness, which is uncontradicted, that the double wrap cap ply is the standard in the industry, and that the single wrap does not work.
Okay. So you're not resting on the patent alone, it's in conjunction with the testimony.
Exactly.
Is this a patent or a patent application?
It's a patent application and a date when the patent is granted. It gives a filing date and it gives about a year and a half later an issuance date.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Slattery. Mr. Daly.
May it please the court. I'm Frank Daly. I represent the People's Continental. With me is my partner Dan LaFave and Tom Armstrong. I'd like to pick up pretty much where we left off with Mr. Slattery's presentation and to get back to what I think are fundamental points in this case that I have been missed in his dialogue. First of all, the fact that there is a patent or a patent application does not constitute something absent other circumstances that is the standard of the industry. There is a patent in evidence in the appendix, I think it's page 114 and on, that is for a single wrap cap ply. 1981, 2 years after these tires were made. An industry person could just as well rely on that patent. Secondly, there's this notion that because there's a double wrap, somehow that's better and makes a single wrap defective. And in a case where a double wrap fails, the argument would be you should have a triple wrap. There is virtually no end to that.
Counsel, on that point, I need some assistance. As I understand this butt splice and this clamp, it's like a C-clamp closed. That's the way that I see it and envision it. And one of the problems I have is that it doesn't take much to persuade me. It is part of my sense that if you have a C-clamp closed, and if there's a potential problem of pressure, it's going to break right there. I mean, I almost want to say I don't care how many experts testify to that or don't. That just makes sense to me. I see it in my necklaces.
I can represent to the court. I don't have any necklaces.
Yeah, that's right.
But I understand.
So So I would say, if there is a known problem, that the steel belts have problems adhering and can come off, and if the remedy is a clamp, I'd say don't put in a C-clamp, because this can happen to the tire. I'd make it 1.5 or 2. Tell me where I'm wrong in that.
I'm not sure. Some people in the tire business would take that approach, Your Honor, but the fact is that there isn't any evidence in this record or otherwise, to my knowledge, which suggests that there are all these accidents and failures involving single wrap cap lines. There is no such evidence. There is no evidence to that effect. We have one higher, an expert. This is the third expert that plaintiffs contacted. The one that testified at trial was the third expert that they consulted. And he was the only one that showed up at trial. Another expert, Mr. Gold, did say that the tires were overinflated. I think this is a question, Your Honor, of, first of all, what constitutes negligence on the part of a manufacturer? If the manufacturer has no notice that the design it uses is perfectly acceptable in the real world, and there's no evidence to suggest to the contrary here, there is no basis for a manufacturer to change a design to conform to what somebody else might think is a better design. And I suspect that if we had tire engineers here, we could probably debate long and hard, and you might come down on the side of a double wrap, others might come down on the side of a single wrap. But what's missing from this record is any indication that Continental had any reason to believe that the single wrap cap fly design was defective and didn't work. There is no evidence to that effect.
I read that there is in this record some testimony that Continental is the only manufacturer that has that kind of butt splice. Does the record support that assertion?
I'm not sure that it does, Your Honor. I'm not sure that that's true. If that's what Mr. Taylor said, I don't think that is true. But let's talk about what happened here. You've heard, certainly, and you're familiar with the facts, and there's no doubt this was a tragic accident, no doubt about that. But we're talking, and to pick up on Mr. Justice Wilcox's comments, this is a Volkswagen Vanagon, an old Volkswagen Vanagon, traveling down to Florida on an interstate highway, towing a catamaran on a trailer and having another sailboat on top of the roof, going anywhere in the high 60s to into the mid-70 mile per hour. Swerving back and forth, the testimony goes. The tires, and the record shows this, that there was ample testimony that these tires were overinflated, not coming from Continental's people, but rather the plaintiff's own witness, Mr. Taylor, agreed with me on cross-examination, finally, that the tires, that there was evidence of overinflation, and that overinflation causes belt separation, number one. Number two, Mr. Gold, another expert that the plaintiffs consulted but didn't call, said that the tires had evidence of overinflation. And a Tech Lube employee, a person that's not involved in this lawsuit at all, testified that when he serviced the car, he saw that these tires were inflated to 45 PSI, well beyond what their recommended inflation was. So there's evidence in this record of overinflation. There's evidence that these were not tires intended for the Vanagon. They have evidence from Mr. Taylor himself, who says that...
Mr. Daly?
Yes, sir.
Excuse my frustration, but that's not your problem, is it? I mean, the jury already has found that they were 50% negligent.
Right.
Your problem here, it seems to me, is to overcome the great deference that this court must give to a jury in finding that there was no evidence in the record to support negligence on the part of your client. So...
I don't disagree, Your Honor. Let me address that straight out. I think when you analyze this record, as the Court of Appeals did, that you find it bereft of any testimony that goes to the conduct of Continental. We have here experienced plaintiff's lawyers. We have experienced experts. There's not one word from their mouths to the effect that there is, to a reasonable degree of probability, the Continental Tire Company was negligent. There isn't one word.
What about Mr. Taylor? How do you... Tell me, if you were writing this decision, how you would write it and totally discounting Mr. Taylor's testimony. Because you have to totally discount it, do you not, to prevail?
Well, I think I can take it into account when I would write that opinion and would say that he did not meet his burden of proof. For one thing, they didn't meet the burden of production of evidence to the effect that it would be more probable than not that these tires would have failed or failed because of a single wrap cat fly design. Mr. Taylor, that's a college's testimony, said that these tires would still fail even if they had a double wrap cat fly. They might fail at a different time. He does not ever connect his complaints with causation. There is simply no, and you can take all of his testimony, there is no place where he says that these tires failed because of Continental's negligence or failure to use ordinary care. There is no place in this record where he says that it's more probable than not that these tires were going to fail because they have a single wrap cap fly design or for any other reason. He just doesn't meet his burden.
He did say that, if I recall, that, and I'm talking now about Victor Blumel, apparently Continental's employee, testified, I have this written down, that the tires would not have failed but for the belt separation and failure of the cap ply. Now, that's not the next step. That's not saying that because of the improper design of the cap ply. But the failure of the cap ply, apparently, according to that witness's testimony, that the tires would not have failed but for the failure of the cap ply. Am I correct? You know, I'm not always...
I think that's general.
I know you have a disagreement with what the record says.
We do, in some respects, but let me answer it this way, Your Honor. I think that a lot of this is semantics, but the fact is that when we're talking about the burden of proof here and the burden of proof of showing not only negligent conduct, but that conduct is more likely than not to have caused the injury or the accident, that's where we part company. Whenever you have a blowout on a tire, there is, by definition, going to be belt separation and the cap ply won't hold. So you could go to tire yards all over the United States and find failed tires that have double wrap cap flies because that's what happens when the tire blows out. So the issue is here we have a tire that was 10 years old at the time that it was sold as new. There is no evidence to show what happened to the tire from the day that it was manufactured in Germany until it got put on Mr. Morden's van again in West Allis, Wisconsin. There's a 10-year lapse. We have no idea where it was stored, what the weather circumstances were. We do know from Mr. Taylor that indeed age does have a factor of making adhesives less powerful. Also, the way the tire is operating.
Let me ask you, sorry to interrupt, but
that's all right, Your Honor.
Because your opposing counsel made that point. There is no shelf life. In other words, what you said was, well, 10 years. It had been on the shelf perhaps too long. Or what is the subject as far as shelf life? Is there a shelf life for a tire or not? Does it? Was that in the testimony? Is that in the record?
I think there was some dispute about that, Your Honor. But there is. I don't think there's any dispute that the older that a tire is, the less there's going to be the power of adhesives to hold it together. What we don't know is whether this tire really was on the shelf, if you will, during those 10 years, or where it was, or how it was stored.
Mr. Daly,
yes,
was Mr. Slattery correct when he told us that there were two tires that failed? They both failed at the same time and failed at the same point?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. Yeah.
Is that not significant?
Not under these circumstances, Your Honor, because his witness, Mr. Shaw, who was an accident reconstruction expert, said that these tires failed because of the significant forces placed upon it. He called it bottoming out. That when the Volkswagen van again, loaded with their luggage and carrying these bolts and things, came across this indentation and bump in the highway, it caused the weight and the speed of the vehicle caused it to bottom out. That's what he says caused the tires to blow out. And he also testified that if the vehicle had been going at a lower speed, that would not have happened. So yes, they failed. They both failed. They failed at the same place, which, according to his testimony, when the car bottoms out and puts all that weight on the tires, that's probably where they're going to fail. And in and of itself is not an indication of a manufacturing defect. You know, I also want to speak to this issue about what the what the record shows in terms of the burden of proof here. We say, and the Court of Appeals agreed, that there is no evidence of any conduct on the part of Continental. The most that they have is an expert who comes in the court and says that double wrap cap flies were there, other people in the industry used them. One conclusion that could easily be drawn is the fact that if Continental used a single wrap cap fly, maybe they didn't have the bell separation problems that Uniroyal had, that Mr. Taylor worked for. But that's all there is. And he says, now what's the real root of the problem with this tire? He says it's because the adhesives didn't hold the belts together, which is, again, what's going to happen in a blowout. And what's the cause of that? He said it could be something in the manufacturing process, even though there's absolutely no evidence of anything in the manufacturing process. Or, he said, it could be because of the operation of the vehicle. So we have the plaintiff's expert on liability saying that it's either or. He doesn't say that it's more probable than not that this occurred because of any negligence on the part of Continental. And without that testimony, they can't meet their burden. It's just not there.
Now, this tire had a cap fly, right? Are these tires?
They did, Your Honor.
So what the allegation here is not that the cap fly, well, I guess it is that the cap fly failed because it was a single rack. Is that what?
No, it failed because the belts were subjected to significant stresses or forces, especially on this bottoming out. They separated wide, and the cap fly didn't hold. Mr. Taylor said, and this is the other significant, this is the plaintiff's expert who says, I don't know. I can't tell you whether the double wrap cap fly would have held those tires together. I don't know that. They might have failed then, they might have failed later, but I can't tell you to a reasonable degree of probability that if these tires had a double wrap cap fly that they would have withstood these forces. And that, Your Honor, we believe is the problem that the plaintiffs have. I know my problem is to show that there's no evidence, and I think that there isn't, and I accept that as my burden, and agree that these are cases that are certainly not things that come along every day, but this is a case where I believe it shows compellingly that there is no evidence, not only of any negligence, but there is no testimony that says that these tires, more probably than not, failed because of any design defect, manufacturing defect, or because of any negligence on the part of Continental.
So you say causation wasn't shown either?
I'm saying that, yes, Your Honor. I don't believe they met their burden on causation. There is no testimony that says it's more probable than not that these tires failed because of negligence or because of the way they are manufactured or because of how they were designed. There's nothing in this record to show any kind of manufacturing defect, any kind of design flaws. There's no evidence of other failures. There's no evidence that they didn't use their normal manufacturing process. There's no evidence that other Continental tires were failing. There's two tires involved in this unusual incident, and that's all there is.
And had Continental been using this tire for many years?
Yes, there are snow tires. I can't tell you exactly how long, and I'm not sure what the record reflects, but these were not just a new or brand new design.
Counsel, what are the responses to there's no evidence of one of your opponent's responses in the brief says, well, one of the reasons there's no evidence is because you don't have the records. Because of the records retention policy, there's no evidence of complaints, because if there were any, they would be gone. There's no evidence of this or that, because if there were any that your company had under your records retention policy, which is consistent with the industry, they'd be gone. How do you respond to that?
By saying, Your Honor, that unless there's some showing of this misconduct here, some sort of deliberate destruction or spoliation of that evidence, which there is no such testimony, and there can't be that, because that's not what the record shows, that the absence of these documents posed a problem for the plaintiffs, that without those documents, their experts said, Mr. Taylor said, I don't have the specifications, I don't have the formulas, I don't have the test results, I don't have customer complaints files, and without that, I can't give you an opinion as to whether or not there's a design defect or manufacturing defect. And that's why, Your Honor, and we're not laying that at the plaintiff's foot as blame, saying that they didn't try the case competently, But they didn't have that evidence, and without that evidence, their expert, by his own admission, said, I cannot give you the opinion that you want. And he didn't. These, as I said, these are experienced lawyers. This is a very experienced expert who testifies against tire companies all the time. And if there was evidence that there was a defect and that the defect caused this failure, certainly that would have been in the record. And there's not a single word.
My recollection of the brief then said, the expert said, so what I'm relying on is the physical tire itself.
Right. Nothing about the conduct, and of course when you look at the physical tire...
I'm sorry for interrupting you.
That's all right.
But then, did he or did he not go into this C-clamp, this butt splice?
I'm glad you're saying that, Ron. I don't want to try to say it.
Could you say that three times real quickly?
I can't.
No, definitely.
I give up. I think he doesn't like our design. I'll give you that. I don't think he does, but there is no basis for his not liking it. He doesn't like our butt splice. He wants double wrap. That's maybe his personal opinion, but it doesn't carry the weight of an expert opinion in a court of law. And I cite the court to this case, which I just as I was struggling with this issue of how you conceptualize this, it's the Beacon Bowl case at 176 Wisconsin 740, 501 Northwest 2nd at page 788. A 1993 case, which talks about the burden of production. That is, the burden of coming forth with evidence that makes an event more probable than not, makes an event more likely to occur. And that's where there was a total failure in this case as well. Not only is there no evidence of any conduct on the part of Continental, neither is there any testimony that meets that burden of production of coming forward by saying that it's more probable than not that any such negligence or any such defect was the proximate cause of the failure of the tires.
Do you have any explanation for the split verdict here, or any interpretation
of it? As the record probably doesn't fully or adequately reflect, this was an extraordinarily contentious trial. It went on for many, many weeks. It was hard fought, and there was many areas of disagreement. The jury performed yeoman-like services, but by the time of the sixth week when they were deliberating, one of the jurors, juror Ianelli, came down and said, I just want out of here. There's no reason left in this room anymore. This verdict came back late on a sunny, warm September Friday afternoon. I think it was a compromise verdict. I think probably people gave up some points and went along with others. Others may have a different approach, but that's given the circumstances of this trial and the conditions of the deliberations. I think it was probably just a matter of compromising back and forth. And when that happens, oftentimes the negligence or the evidence rather is not fully appreciated or fully reviewed.
Mr. Daly, was the jury unanimous in regard to the negligence verdict?
I believe they were, Your Honor.
And it's my understanding that the reason that the trial court did not approve... ...your liability verdict was that you didn't have the same 10 jurors agreeing as to each of the questions asked in that regard. Is that right?
You're also correct, Justice Crooks. That's right.
Given that, how do you argue that this is a compromise verdict if you've got a unanimous jury in regard to the question of negligence and the question of causation, and you've got 10 out of 12, even though they may not be the same 10, answering the questions in regard to the strict liability verdict, how does this become a compromise verdict?
I answered it that way, Justice Brooks, because I frankly am bereft of any other explanation for how you had all of these differences of opinion, except to say that we have the testimony of one juror who portrayed a situation where the jury was extraordinarily contentious, they were very upset, etc. With respect to the strict liability verdict, Your Honor, I'd also say that there was an opportunity there. As that jury verdict came back, the plaintiff's counsel knew that the strict liability verdict was defective. They had the opportunity then to have the trial judge re-instruct the jury, let the jury go back and deliberate,
We had the same jury there. All the exhibits were there. The judge was there. They chose not to do that. I tactically made a decision that we're going to take the bird in the hand, which is the negligence verdict, and not the other. And that's why also contained on this appeal is the issue about whether they waived this right to a new trial. And our strong position on it is that they did. Not only did they waive it then, but they did not raise it in motions after verdict. They didn't raise it in the Court of Appeals until after they lost. So with respect to one of the requests for relief at this level, Your Honor, on the issue of remanding it for a new trial, our position is, as was sustained by the Court of Appeals, that it's too late, that they made a tactical, concentrated decision. And now, because they've made that decision, they have to live with those consequences as they turned out to be.
I want to explore the remaining issues, if there are any. If we would affirm the Court of Appeals and say there's insufficient evidence to sustain the verdict, are there any other issues that we need address? I note the Court of Appeals said they need not address any other issues. And the same question I ask if we would hold that there is, consistent with the statute, some credible evidence to support it. Are there other issues that we have to address?
Well, I believe that your decision in affirming the Court of Appeals would be dispositive.
Okay. If we reverse the Court of Appeals with regard to the question of sufficiency of evidence, are there other issues for us to address?
In other words, you would reverse and say that there's a matter of law, there's enough evidence to support the verdict. Frankly, I can't think that we'd have any other. There's issues about this new trial, but that's really an issue about their defect in the verdict.
I think there was one, maybe.
There's an issue about the release of Swagger,
yeah, right.
Or not?
That would be with respect to an issue that could occur in the event of a new trial. Yes, I mean, our position was that at the time of the trial, the Volkswagen had settled out and paid $500,000, and that the jury was never advised of that. It significantly changed the position of the parties in the case, not only with respect to bias, but it allowed plaintiff's counsel to, an opening statement, tell the jury he was going to save them 3 or 4 weeks because he wasn't going to put them through this trial against Volkswagen, thereby ingratiating himself to the jury. And we were not allowed to tell the jury that it's not because he's worried about 3 or 4 more weeks of your time, it's because he's just taken $500,000 from Volkswagen. It puts us in a very difficult position. We then, in the trial, have testimony from the plaintiff that her situation as a result of her injury is so dramatic that she cannot even afford to buy a pair of shoes. Now, we had two jurors cry when that was said. And I again renewed my objection, moved for a mistrial, and asked that at this point, surely, we ought to be allowed to tell the jury that there was a settlement and that there was a substantial sum of money paid. And again, that was refused. And it put us in a tenuous position, and we were not allowed to even refer to the fact that there had been a settlement. So I think if there was to be a retrial, certainly we'd want the opportunity to be able to have the jury instructed about the settlement. But, as I said, Your Honor, our main position is that the Court of Appeals decision was correct, that there is not evidence to support the verdict, and that under the Beacon Bold case, neither is there testimony that carries the day either on negligence or strict liability with respect to causation.
If we do affirm the Court of Appeals on that issue, though, then we do have to address this issue of the mistrial of the strict liability claim.
If you affirm the Court of Appeals on the negligence issue, Your Honor, then I think plaintiffs would renew their request for a new trial based upon the notion it was a mistrial. Our position is that they clearly waived that, and at any event, that would deprive us then of the opportunity to have presented our position to the Court of Appeals on strict liability, which would have been the same as it was on evidence, namely, that there's not enough evidence to support a verdict on strict liability either. And if this court were to remand this matter to a trial court, we would have then been deprived of the opportunity to have the Court of Appeals consider our position that the strict liability verdict is defective as well.
So your argument is that not only was it waived at the trial court when there was no request for a re-instruction of the jury, but it was waived at the Court of Appeals?
Correct. And my final position is that in any event, it would deprive Continental of the opportunity to have had the Court of Appeals consider our position, which was that on this record, you didn't meet the burden of production, you didn't have testimony that made this accident more probable than not because of any defect in the tire or because of any negligence.
I assume that the trial court gave the standard instruction on a 5-6 verdict, which tells the jury that the same 10 jurors have to agree on all the answers in the verdict.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. Yes, I remember that.
All right. So even if the request had been made for a re-instruction of the jury at the time of the invalid verdict, that would have been a discretionary call for the trial court. He could have refused and said, I already gave that instruction. They've been in there for 5 days or however long it's been. I'm not going to engage in this exercise.
Right. Well, sure, the trial judge, it would be addressed to his sound discretion, but given the length of the trial and I think everybody's interest in not having to incur the expense and time of having to go through a whole separate trial, I would think, and I can't speak for the trial judge, but I would think that it would be at least something he would have seriously considered and
sure,
perhaps
like
granted.
The hung jury instruction, that's a discretionary call for the trial judge about whether it's worth giving or not, which is rarely reversed.
Right.
Mr. Daly, did the jurors have all of the instructions, written instructions, with them in the jury room?
I believe they did, Your Honor. I believe they did. And
given the length of this trial, I'm not suggesting this, but on the 5-6 issue, I note that the same 10 agreed on the strict liability questions and causation, strict liability and causation. Is there any room for, was there any discussion of bifurcating this in terms of on a retrial, just going to damages, and would that work?
Well, Your Honor, there wasn't any discussion ever. I don't believe. I believe that we did file, Continental filed a motion requesting a bifurcated trial, I believe. It's been a long time, but I think that should be in the record. I think we did ask for a bifurcated trial, and that motion was turned down. But as we sit here at this stage, we have to look at the record that was developed. And what certainly was a very fully tried case. This is not a situation where anybody was rushed to judgment. Everybody had an opportunity to present their case. Plaintiffs had ample opportunity. They chose, for whatever reason, not to ask their expert whether the expert had an opinion to a reasonable degree of probability as to whether Continental was negligent, as to whether the tires were defective, as to whether the negligence or defect was the proximate cause of the injuries. And I think that the reason that they did that was not because they're incompetent or careless lawyers, but they made a calculated decision to do that because they knew that under the circumstances, their witness would not have been able to give them the opinion that they wanted, and they chose instead not to ask those questions, and therefore, the record does not support a claim that they've proved their case.
Mr. Daly, I think you said in your argument that overinflation causes belt separation.
I did, Your Honor.
And I think you also said that age does have a factor in adhesion.
And I said that as well, Your Honor, quoting the experts in the case, yes.
Both overinflation and the age of the tires are foreseeable for a manufacturer. Was there any evidence in the record that either of these factors could be affected, or let's put it this way, is there any evidence in the record that a double overlap does better when these factors exist than a single?
I don't believe there is, Your Honor. And I would say this, that while a manufacturer may reasonably anticipate some overinflation or aging, I don't think any witness, even maybe Mr. Taylor, would say that a tire manufacturer expects a tire that it manufactured 12 years ago to be running down an interstate highway. That's not something that's reasonably foreseeable. It's not something that happens in the real world. My time is up. I'm happy to entertain any more questions. I thank you for your time.
Justice Babbage.
At some point in the record, Mr. Taylor...
No, it's for you, Mr. Daly.
At some point in the record, Mr. Taylor discusses the 71 patent, and he says, quote, that the technology, and he's talking about the double layer, it's, quote, generally accepted in the tire industry. Now, I have not read Mr. Taylor's testimony. I'm taking this from the brief of the plaintiff. Could you comment on that?
I think it's Mr. Taylor's, I know it's Mr. Taylor's opinion to that effect, Your Honor, but I don't, that was his opinion.
Was that rebutted at all?
Not directly, no. I mean, other than through cross-examination, showing that there's other patents, such as the one we have in evidence, as Exhibit 746. That
and why is that not sufficient to comply with the verdict?
Because it doesn't, first of all, it doesn't show that there was any evidence to suggest that the application they were using, the single wrap, had any problems with it, and that the safer design, if it was a safer alternative, there was no evidence to suggest that the design they had was in any way defective, because there was no evidence that those tires with single wrap cap fly designs ever failed.
Well, does your argument come down to that there may be a safer and safest way of making these tires? This may have been safe, but not safest, and that's good enough.
I think there's always that argument in products cases, Your Honor, and there's virtually no end logically to the notion that you could always make a product that's safer, but the issue is whether they used reasonable care and whether there's any evidence to suggest that they didn't. And there's also the issue of whether the failure to use that kind of reasonable care that a reasonably prudent manufacturer would use, which is a burden of ordinary care, was somehow breached in this case, and it was that breach of that duty that was the proximate cause of these injuries. And they absolutely did not have that part of the syllogism that they have to have, and it's just fatally defective because it's not there.
Thank you, Mr.
Taylor. Thank you, Your
Honor.
Thank you.
Mr. Slattery.
Mr. Daly and I appear to be arguing from different records. First of all, Taylor specifically testified he knew of no other manufacturer that used a butt splice such as Continental used here. The citation for that is at page 16 of our brief, item number 3, with a record cite. He specifically testified that this accident would not have happened as it did with a double wrap. The specific record citation is at page 17 of our brief, item number 19. None of these things have ever been replied to by Condon. We cite 18 specific record references of proof of negligence that are totally unresponded to by Condon. He says overinflation causes belt separation. That is directly contradicted by Taylor. He produced a test, Exhibit 150, that says only if tires are defective can overinflation even contribute to belt separation. And when we're talking about things like overinflation or misuse of the tires, I believe Justice Babbage is correct. Those are assumed in the comparison of fault and causation findings that this jury made. Look what they did with Tom Morton. They came back and asked for instructions when the question posed was he negligent for the selection of the tires or their maintenance. They asked that the conjunctive and was used in the original verdict. The jury came back and asked for instructions. Do you mean and or? Can we find one or the other? They found negligence and circled it. And if Tom Morton was negligent at all, that only related to overinflating the tires. They then found that not causal. Because the only proof, there isn't a single witness in this case who's offered one shred of evidence that anything in the operation of the tires caused the belt separation or the cap ply splice or the failure. You have Jack Taylor. They didn't call witnesses. And to the extent that their witnesses were in agreement with what Mr. Taylor was called, was producing here, we read in his testimony as part of our case. Taylor further testified that the only purpose of a cap fly, its only function, is to prevent small separations from growing into the sort of massive ones that we have here. That continental cap fly failed in its essential basic purpose.
Counsel, does the record have any question that is similar to this? Mr. Expert, you have an opinion to reasonable expert probability, engineering probability, that the defendant was negligent. Do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of probability that it was causal? Does the record contain any question?
With respect to the cap ply and the butt splice, it absolutely does.
Where's the reference to that?
On the question of cause, the one that I just gave the court, page 17 of our brief, item number 18, record reference 440, pages 1520 and 1521. He directly testified to that. He testified to the misuse of a single wrap and that no other manufacturer makes it this way, and he testified to cause that the accident would not have happened in this manner had a double wrap been used.
Well, look at 12 on page 17. The tires were defective when they left Continental because the splice was not sufficient to take care of the tire for its useful life.
That is absolutely right.
Right. Was that direct testimony saying that in accordance with the expert opinion, the magic language about what's your opinion to a reasonable degree of certainty?
Absolutely, Your Honor. This is testimony that these tires failed from the inside out, not from the outside in. That's why it's so dangerous. That's why it's so unacceptable to allow those massive belt separations to develop.
And look at 8. Any cap ply must have enough strength to hold the cap ply. These were not strong enough to hold the tire together.
Absolutely. The cap ply has a function to resist these large forces that are put on the tire by flexing and by going around at high speed. And if you do this C-clamp sort of thing, it's physics that you're not going to hold it together. It's too weak. A splice is a weakness. It's a concentration of forces. That's direct testimony of the witness. Question of shelf life, there is absolutely no question. And the record is uncontradicted. Continental set no shelf life on these tires. They could be sold 10 years later. If there had been any evidence in this case that storage or shelf life was in any way causally related to the failure of these tires, we would have asked for a warning instruction. There is no such causal testimony because there's no warning. There's no way to tell somebody how to find out the age of the tires. Tom Morton didn't know when these tires were manufactured. The man who sold the tires, Lee Lewandowski, did not know how to read the code on the tire that indicated the date of manufacture. Both of them thought the tires were new. There's no warning or anything by Continental to say, hey, if these tires are 10 years old, don't buy them. You and I, uninstructed by a tire inspector, an expert, could not walk in and tell the date of tire manufacture. They code by week in the last digit of the year. 44-9 means the 44th week of a year ending with the last digit 9. It could be 1969, 79, or 89. And you would have no way of knowing that. None. If that's significant, show me the proof in the record that says it's significant. There is none.
Mr. Slattery, your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Slattery. Thank you, Mr. Daly. We are in a recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45.